It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host Veronica Rickard is off this week. Coming up on Central Time, a recent New York Times report says that Governor Walker is changing his accent as he prepares a likely bid for the presidency. We'll hear what you think and what a Wisconsin accent really sounds like. First, Indiana has gotten a lot of heat since Governor Mike Pence signed the state's Religious Freedom Restoration Act into law last week. Critics of the law say it was crafted to allow businesses to discriminate against the LGBT community. Those who support the law deny those accusations. They say it mimics laws in other states and federal law. Since the Indiana governor signed the law, business leaders and politicians around the country have announced sanctions against the state. Indianapolis-based Angie's List said it's canceling a $40 million expansion in the city. CEOs of Apple and Yelp have written opposition articles, and mayors of cities like San Francisco and Seattle have banned city-funded travel to Indiana. Governor Pence went on This Week with George Stephanopoulos on Sunday to defend the law. He declined to say whether it allowed for-profit businesses to discriminate against gay people. Here's a clip from that interview.
Yes or no? If a florist in Indiana refuses to serve a gay couple at their wedding, is that legal now in Indiana?
George, this is where this debate has gone with misinformation and frankly,
it's just a question, sir. Yes or no?
Well, there's been shameless rhetoric about my state and about this law and about its intention all over the internet. People are trying to make it about one particular issue, and now you're doing that as well.
Here with us now to talk about this law in Indiana is Kimmy King. She's professor of political science at the University of North Texas and Central Times legal affairs correspondent. Kimmy, good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you.
Let's pick up that conversation between George Stephanopoulos and Governor Pence. Having looked at this law, would the situation be as Stephanopoulos is describing? Could private businesses discriminate against gay people under this new law?
It certainly is the case that with the new law, they have additional legal fodder for making the argument that they were not required to serve that couple. But it's also a function of the Burwell Hobby Lobby case, which came down, which said that employers, private employers, have the ability to restrict or to prevent, you know, prohibit providing health care, birth control, to persons for religious reasons. So between both the Indiana ordinance and previous Supreme Court precedent, you have an ability to make a much stronger case than you would have otherwise had.
Now, I've seen a real split in what people are saying and writing about this Indiana law. On one hand, people are saying, hey, 19 other states have what are called Religious Freedom Restoration Acts in place. So does the federal government. Same thing in Indiana. Other people are saying, no, there are small but very important distinctions in this Indiana law that make it functionally different. Where do you come down on that, or what do you see as the arguments on both sides there?
I think that the key issue is then what is the intent of the state in passing the law, and that certainly would be something that they look at as, you know, if and when, and I think it will be a when, a case is brought regarding this kind of issue. They will look to see what was the intent of the legislators. Were they looking to single out or target specific groups, specifically LGBT groups? Was it that they were trying to target that group, or is it more that they are trying to protect the religious freedom? So one sharp distinction that's been pointed out is that if you go back and look at when other states have passed their RFRAs or their Religious Freedom Restoration Act laws, to give those with religious beliefs greater support for making those arguments in court, making it more difficult for the government to interfere with your religious beliefs, the LGBT issue and gay marriage in particular was not tied into it. So that's one important distinction. The second distinction, and I'm always amazed at the extent to which, you know, the Midwestern states like Wisconsin or Indiana are really lockstep with some of our southern states like Texas, is that the Indiana law allows private individuals to be involved in these lawsuits, as does the Texas law, whereas other RFRAs say we're trying to leave it in the hands of government and to see to it that government is trying not targeting you for your religious beliefs. But Indiana seems to have opened up the door a little bit more through the way in which this law is written, allowing private individuals that opportunity to be able to challenge state policies. And I think all of this is must be cast against the backdrop because the Supreme Court is about to hear the gay marriage case, and everybody has been discussing that. And so I think that's another issue and another reason why this case is kind of riveting the national attention, because everyone is anticipating what is going to be probably the most important decision of the court's term and the oral arguments that are going to be heard this next month.
Talking to Central Time Legal Affairs correspondent Kimmy King about the controversial Indiana religious freedom law passed last week. A lot of backlash against that around the country since then. And Kimmy, it's interesting how these religious freedom restoration acts have morphed. As I understand it, when they were passed, it was to protect things like a Native American sacred site from having a highway built through it, a Muslim prison guard being allowed to have some facial hair, not having that restricted, that kind of thing. It's really been morphing, hasn't it?
Yes, although in fairness to those that are supportive of the law, understand that laws always morph. And this idea that there is this thing of the law is really just a misnomer. And so I think you'll see across society, if you look, for example, going back to even interracial marriage and the first arguments that came out about that, understand that everyone always takes any kind of new law and uses it for its own purposes. So it is absolutely the case that these laws have morphed, and it is absolutely the case that people are increasingly challenging them, whether it's a baker in New Mexico or a florist in Washington or wherever it is. People have consistently been using laws to promote some kind of social change, either to the left or to the right. And what you're seeing here is the use of the law to promote social change to swing back toward a more conservative perspective.
What an interesting twist on what's happened in Indiana is, outside the legal side of it, the political and the economic response. Are you surprised to see companies based in Indiana, based elsewhere, reacting so strongly against this new law?
I'll be quite candid. I'm actually rather surprised that the governor has taken so much heat and stood up for it in a way that, for example, you saw Governor Jan Brewer in Arizona when they had a similar law raised there that she vetoed it because she said it would be disastrous for business. So I think one of the things that's surprising is that the governor has been willing to take the heat in the face of this economic hardship that will and is already being visited along, on the state. What will be striking is to see the extent to which Indiana responds in 3 months or in 6 months, because you will see not only the pressure coming from economic business being lost, but then they're going to be facing litigation and lawsuits as a result of the law. And those two factors together may get the legislature and the governor to change their mind.
Is there kind of a perfect storm here? You mentioned the Supreme Court case coming up, the presidential race, and the governor of Indiana has been mentioned as a possibility. The Final Four going on next weekend in Indianapolis. Maybe this is getting more attention than it would have been at some hypothetical, probably non-existent neutral time.
I think putting it as a perfect storm is a great way to put it. In general, I would say this issue is on the agenda and has been for the last 2 to 3 years in ways that, quite honestly, and I've said this before, going back a decade, no one anticipated. I think an additional part of that perfect storm is that there has been a sea change in the collective perspective on gay marriage and this attitude. And once you saw moderate to conservative Republicans come out in support of gay marriage, the tide began to shift, and we're still in that phase where it's almost like the waves are coming up on the beach, and they're just getting stronger, and they're going to continue until the Supreme Court finally resolves this issue about can the states ban gay marriage.
We're talking with Central Time legal affairs correspondent Kimmy King of the University of North Texas, looking at Indiana's Religious Freedom Restoration Act. We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you following this story? What do you think about this new law? If you support it, do you think clarifications need to be made, as the governor of Indiana has mentioned? In 2013, Wisconsin lawmakers introduced a similar constitutional amendment. Do we need something like that here? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with Kimmy King from the University of North Texas, talking about Indiana's Religious Freedom Restoration Act. It changes the laws in that state. Critics say it is legalizing discrimination, especially against lesbians and gays in Indiana. So we're just saying, no, this is an attempt to protect religious liberty for individuals, for business owners and others. You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think about this law and the idea behind it? If you support it, do you think it needs to be clarified given all the backlash against it? Would you support something like this here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Sean on the line in Wausau. Sean, hi.
Hey, Rob, Veronica, Kimmy, thanks for taking my call.
What do you think of this, Sean?
I'm just wondering, does this religious protection, does it extend to all religions, or is it just for mainstream Christian denominations? I mean, could a business owner who happened to be a member of the Nation of Islam say, I'm no longer going to be serving white devils in my business because my religious beliefs say I don't have to? Or, I mean, where does it end? I mean, if you're going to allow everyone to say, well, this is my religious belief, and therefore I'm just going to discriminate against this whole section of society.
Sean, thanks a lot for the call. Kimmy, I assume the law doesn't specify a particular religion, but could this be tested in ways like Sean was talking about?
It absolutely could be tested in ways that he is raising, although it will depend upon the particular state in question. So a couple things to get at. One is that if we look at the First Amendment, we need to think of it in two parts. The part of it that says government can't establish a religion, that's the Establishment Clause, and then the fact that government's not supposed to interfere with the free exercise of your religion. So this clearly falls down on the free exercise side of it. What is striking when you look at the history of the Free Exercise Clause is that it has been used to protect those persons who are typically of a minority religion. And so, for example, it's been used to say that the Amish, for example, can take their children out of the public schools in eighth grade because at that point they need to be more focused on working in the fields and becoming indoctrinated into their community through their belief systems. So when we think of the Free Exercise Clause, it has largely protected minority religions. And what is also striking about this Indiana law is it's not even identifying the LGBT issue, right? Mm-hmm. And so it just simply gives you almost permission to say that if there are things that are at odds with your religious beliefs, that the government cannot force you to do it unless, and here's a key point I want to follow up with on the caller, unless government has a compelling government interest. And so to the extent that a restaurant doesn't want to serve white devils, as the caller pointed out, that gets at a racial bias, which is prohibited by the 14th Amendment. And so the government probably wouldn't have a hard time. It'd be a little easier for them to show that we have a compelling government interest in seeing to it that people are not racially discriminated against. But it does open up the possibility of unique legal challenges because it provides individuals with unique religious beliefs to assert those religious beliefs as reasons for why they're discriminating.
Sean, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Barb in Chippewa Falls. Barb, hi.
Hello. Thank you for having this program. I will state that I don't agree with the legislation, and I will kind of piggyback off the previous caller. My concern is I don't understand I've seen Governor Pence try to clarify, and that there was no clarification for me. And I thought he was referring to maybe rewording the legislation or something, but I don't see how any, even an amendment, say that, you know, protects gays and lesbians. I am not sure, given how he is, you know, kind of doubling down and going to stay with this and try to clarify it. I don't see how this isn't an incredible slippery slope, like the former caller said. Where does it end? And so that is my comment. And I will also ask your guest if there is any amendment that she could see that would, you know, that would reduce the backlash, I guess, against this.
Barb, thanks for the call. Kimmy, is there something they could tweak here that might satisfy the people who are currently threatening effectively boycotts here?
Well, I think that it's not politically likely. There is that possibility. And so, for example, if you have a number of religious freedom states that have non-discrimination laws put in place statewide, Connecticut, Illinois, New Mexico, and Rhode Island, so if the governor were to try to court business back, he could say, we'll try to pass legislation that protects, you know, LGBT persons from being discriminated against. I don't think that's politically likely, given when you look at the legislative intent and the history behind that RFRA law. But that is one way in which you might try to limit some of that backlash, as it were. I think that the most powerful tool that the general public will have will be the boycott of Indiana business and the travel of business and tourism to the state. You've already seen, I believe it's out in California, refusing to pay for people to fly out to do business in Indiana if necessary on the state's dime. So you're going to start seeing other public entities take that perspective, and I think that is really the biggest, that will have the biggest kind of influence on the politics there.
We're talking to Central Time legal affairs correspondent Kimmy King about the controversial Indiana religious freedom law that's in the news big time this last week. We'll go to a caller now. We've got Brian with us in Fond du Lac. Brian, hi.
Yeah, I had a couple of comments and a question. First of all, this bill may have had a little bit more traction for some of the people in the public in the time of extreme economic difficulty. Now the economy is coming back. There's a less of a need, I think, on the part of people to scapegoat a particular group. And this is a sociological principle that goes way back to the days of Hitler. I mean, the separated Jewish communities and even some caused themselves a great deal of pain because they weren't allowed to be integrated into the German society. Second comment that I wanted to make was that if you, or a question rather, was if this is by intent a discriminatory law, by definition it is, who is being discriminated against if Mike Pence has been backwalking it, saying he had no intentions of it being discriminatory against gays?
Brian, thanks a lot for the call. So even if the spelled out intent of the law isn't discriminatory, I guess, is it possible that it could be, Kimmy?
Yeah, so every law, when you look at it, you can look at the law on its face and you can look at it as applied. And so on its face, it's not targeting LGBT groups. I mean, one of the things that this is very similar to is going back to something that happened in Colorado back in the mid-1990s, and that is they were trying to stem the tide of local municipalities that were extending rights and privileges that prohibited discrimination against LGBT persons in the provision of local jobs, local employment, local housing, that sort of thing. So the state of Colorado passed a statewide amendment that said local municipalities don't get to make determinations about this discrimination. We do, and any of those laws are null and void. Well, it went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, state government, you don't get to decide to do these things as well. So what you really see in essence is this kind of power shift as cases work their way through the courts, and how you see the discrimination may depend upon the perspective that you take. For example, the reason why this RFRA law has been put forward is because it's the idea is that you're trying to make it so that if government is forcing you to do something, they better have a really good, a compelling government reason if they're going to try to substantially burden your religious belief. And so the argument that was put forward when the legislation was proffered was that we're trying to protect and keep from those with religious beliefs from being discriminated against. The difficulty gets into how do you allow those kinds of cases to be brought, and where Indiana's law is a little unique is it's not reaching out and saying, look, if you're a minister and it's at odds with the tenets of your religion to marry a gay couple in your church, we can give you an exemption under that RFRA law, because now you're getting at, we don't want your religious beliefs to be interfered with, as opposed to someone can just provide any reason for why it is that they are needing to discriminate against any group. And that's where I think the Indiana law may get into a little bit more trouble.
We'll be watching this as it comes into effect. Kimmy, thanks as always for joining us.
You betcha. You take care out there, folks.
Thanks. That was Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas and Central Time legal affairs correspondent, talking about Indiana's new Religious Freedom Restoration Act. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is off today. What role do regional accents play in American politics? Do they help make politicians feel more down-to-earth, or do they come across as, you know, provincial? A recent New York Times article noted that Governor Scott Walker has begun to change, to soften his Wisconsin accent, maybe in an attempt to broaden his appeal nationally. It's a little subtle, but we have some examples we can listen to here. We've got Governor Scott Walker saying Wisconsin. This is two times now. The first time, some years ago. The second, more recent.
Good evening. I'm running for governor because I love this state, and I believe in Wisconsin. If they can work in Wisconsin, they can work anywhere in the country.
Okay, so there's the difference, Wisconsin, Wisconsin. I exaggerated a bit. Can, and that O sound. Here's a second example. Our key word here is economy. First, again, an older version, the second more recent.
He's not only scared about the economy, believe that you grow the economy.
Economy, economy. Well, here with us now to talk about accents and politics is William LeBove. He's a professor of linguistics at the University of Pennsylvania. He's been studying regional pronunciations and the Midwest and beyond for quite some time now. His books include Dialect Diversity in America, The Politics of Language. William, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
So listening to those clips, you've been studying this, as I said, for some time now. Do you hear a big difference in old versus new Wisconsin governor there?
Well, Patrick Healy really picked up the reality of language change in Wisconsin. He just saw it as one particular item. Actually, it's a widespread phenomenon that involves not only the words spelled with short O, like economy and Wisconsin, but also five other vowels in the system of this province. Secondly, he picked up something which is not just peculiar to Wisconsin, but it involves a whole sweep of states from western New York State to Detroit and Cleveland and Chicago and Milwaukee. So it was interesting to us because up to now, only linguists have noticed and described this pattern. Our Atlas of North American English shows that 88 million people are marching in the same direction, but it hasn't come to public attention.
Yeah, this is amazing. This isn't just a Wisconsin accent, but you say it sweeps from Wisconsin all the way to parts of New York State. What are the key defining elements of this accent? Well, first of all, what do we call this accent that covers this huge region?
Well, the linguists call it the Northern City Shift because it was found in all the big cities around the Great Lakes, and it involves a shift like a game of musical chairs. The first thing that happened was that the words spelled with short A moved up to the sound of yeah. That's common enough before letters M and N in most parts of the country. People say man and stand. But in this area, people said that. And in Scott Walker's pronunciation, you'll hear taxes, capacity.
Okay.
And after short A moved up and got out of the way, short O moved forward to occupy the same spot. And that's what you've been hearing in economy and got. It's strongest in words that begin with a G or a K. So I got the job is something that you'll hear quite frequently. And it turns out that Wisconsin has a K before the O, and economy. So that's why those two words were cited. They're the ones that you hear what we call a fronting of short O.
Interesting. And, so what's the, I know there's a few other vowels involved in this, but where does this come from? What's the history behind the origins of this type of English, this type of accent?
Well, we've got a theory, which can't be proved yet, but it's just a theory, which is that it all started with the building of the Erie Canal. New York was New York governor decided that was the way the West was going to be opened up and the American economy would be stimulated by building a canal from the Hudson River to Lake Erie. And the people from all over New England came to this from 1817 to 1825 when it was finished. And it was a agricultural and economical boon to the whole area. And at that time, people came from various parts of New England with different kinds of pronunciation. And a common form was more or less decided on unconsciously, whereas, as I mentioned, in many parts, the letter A is sounded as air and man and stand. But this was changed to the rule saying all words spelled with letter A are going to be pronounced as air. So people say that and fact and capacity and taxes.
We're talking to linguist William LeBove about regional accents in the United States, prompted by some national attention to Governor Scott Walker's changing accent, a softening of his Midwestern accent as he hits the campaign trail. You can join in. What does a Wisconsin accent sound like to you? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. William LeBove, big picture. I would assume, you know, with TV and radio and the internet, that regional accents would be disappearing. We'd all start to sound the same over time. You've studied how this changes over time. Are we talking alike more, or are these regional accents still going strong?
Surprisingly enough, our Atlas of North American English shows the opposite of common sense. Instead of all accents becoming the same, a number of them are getting stronger, and this northern city shift is the best example. But it's also true in Pittsburgh and true in the West, where new sound changes are appearing. But some accents are receding. The southern accent is now strongest in oldest people and weaker in younger people. And certain small cities like Charleston have lost their local accent. But in this region for Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland, Grand Rapids, Flint, the bigger the city, the stronger the accent, and the younger the person, the stronger the accent.
And we've mentioned that Governor Scott Walker apparently is trying to soften this accent. Do you think that there, outside of this region, is there a stigma against this urban and northern shift, or is it acceptable to the rest of the country to hear people talk like we do?
No, I think that it was quite unconscious, and this is surprising to me because up to now, it's been below the radar. So it could have happened, of course, that gradually people become aware of it. But when people talk about where is the best English spoken, people in Michigan say Michigan. People in Wisconsin say Wisconsin. And the worst English is off there down in the south somewhere. So nobody has picked this up, but Patrick Healy, who wrote that article, has a keen ear. And he picked exactly the words where he was expected to be strongest. And it's so interesting because Scott Walker was not born in Wisconsin. He was born in Colorado Springs. And he moved to Delavan at the age of 10. And for linguists, that's particularly interesting because 10 years old is just about the time when you've had enough time in your formative years left that you can become a native speaker. So he's become a native speaker of Wisconsin, or we would say the Northern City Shift. And he moved in just in time to do it. If he had come at 17 or 18, he wouldn't have that accent.
Hmm. Now, how hard is it to consciously change, to do a Henry Higgins, Eliza Doolittle, My Fair Lady kind of thing, and intentionally change our accent? Or is it just, like trying to stop breathing air in a way?
Well, most people will say, I'm a chameleon. I change my accent no matter who I'm talking to, but they exaggerate it. Certain key sounds people can concentrate on and change. And some people are wizards, famous actors. Anthony Hopkins could play Richard Nixon in a very convincing American accent. But most of us stay with the pattern that we have when we were 16, 17 years old, when our system more or less shut down and freezes. But for certain keywords, people will change. And Scott Walker may or may not have some training in this respect, but I think that the article was very keen in pointing out that this is part of his general shift of personality to deal with people in different parts of the country, and was stated that he said, y'all, to the Southerners. And that's a pretty conscious shift.
We're talking to William LeBove, professor of linguistics at the University of Pennsylvania, about Governor Scott Walker's accent. A recent New York Times article said it seems like he's changing his Wisconsin accent as he travels the country ahead of a likely presidential bid. We'd like to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Do you notice this thing we're calling a Wisconsin accent? Have you ever left the state and had somebody recognize your accent? Or if you're not from Wisconsin, what do we sound like here? Do you think regional accents play a role in politics? We're back with William LeBove. He's a professor of linguistics at the University of Pennsylvania, and we're talking about Governor Walker's accent, the Wisconsin accent in general. Actually, it spreads, accent, our guest says, from Wisconsin all the way to upstate New York. A recent New York Times report said that Governor Walker is changing, consciously or not, his Wisconsin accent as he travels the country ahead of a likely bid for president. Think Wisconsin, Wisconsin. Economy, economy. I'm exaggerating a little. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think there is such a thing as a Wisconsin accent? Do you have it? Do you hear it in other people? If you're from out of the state, what is it? What do we sound like to you? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now with Dino in Madison. Dino, hi.
Hi there. Yeah, just a couple of comments. I'm not sure if Walker is consciously trying to change his accent. Based on the audio, I barely hear a difference, and I don't think that the entrepreneur would hear a difference. But I do know that politicians do this all the time. If I could just give you two quick recent examples. Number one is George Bush. He spent most of his adult life in New England, yet if he addresses a local crowd, he puts on the Texas drawl. Second example would be Obama. When Obama addresses the Senate, he sounds like a newscaster. When he addresses a local crowd, he puts on kind of an urban, stereotypically black accent, even though that really is not the people he was raised amongst. I think it's really disingenuous. I don't like it, but I think all politicians do it. I'll just list it off here. Thanks. Bye.
Dino, thanks a lot for the call. Go ahead.
But, sometimes people exaggerate these things. Sarah Palin was very much criticized for her accent, who said she was putting on dropping the G's. But I did a little study of President Obama and Sarah Palin, and they shift exactly the same way when they're talking to formally in a public speech. They say working, and they shift back to working when there's doing a barbecue on the White House lawn. So we tend sometimes to hit people over the head when they produce a particular sound that we don't like. Still, I think that there is a conscious effort of some politicians, and you're pointing to Bush was a good point.
Thanks a lot for the call. Dino, we'll go now to John in Windsor. John, hi.
Yes, I maintain, because of being a minister's kid and moving every 3 years, that's because he's a minister's kid. And as a minister's kid, you have to adapt. And, you know, when you live in Sheboygan versus Waupaca versus Niagara versus Hudson versus Beloit, there's different syntax everywhere you go. Like, for instance, in Madison, would you call it Shawano County, or would you call it like they call it up there, Shawano County? Okay? I mean, it's just, I think that this is a coping mechanism, and, you know, he's pretty good at it.
John, thanks a lot. That's an interesting point. Are some of us language chameleons, maybe ministers' kids who move around, or maybe people who grew up with parents in the military? We're chameleons if we're used to lots of different settings, William.
I think that John's pronunciation illustrated that he's participating in this big shift. He didn't say adapt, he said adapt. And didn't say Madison, he said Madison. So this is a change. It doesn't affect all of Wisconsin. But there's another change that I might mention, which really marks Wisconsin as being different. It's the raising of short A before G in bag.
Oh, yeah.
So Wisconsin people will say big. And when they go to other parts of the country and ask for a paper bag, people don't know what they're talking about.
We were talking about that before the show, and that we think northeastern Wisconsin in particular, you might get a bag of
yeah.
bagels, actually, instead of a bag of bagels.
Fond du Lac, Milwaukee.
Interesting.
And it's a vague tendency in the rest of Canada to say bag, but actually to Mick Jagger, and it sounds like bagel.
Talking to linguist William LeBove about Wisconsin's accent, Governor Scott Walker's accent, what we sound like when we talk. We'll go next to Kira in Eau Claire. Kira, hi.
Hi there.
What do you think?
Well, I had two thoughts while you guys were talking. One was I heard a report on the news that said that a lot of different states will try to hire newscasters with Wisconsin accents because people tend to trust them more because their accent makes them just more trustworthy, I guess. And I thought that was interesting. When I lived in California, people would make fun of my accent all the time. And I remember some guy telling me that my accent sounded like a slice of pie. And so I think there is kind of like some sort of, you know, maybe just a homey feeling about it. But I thought that that was ironic that when I heard you guys say that Scott Walker was trying to get rid of it, because I think he could probably use to be a little more trusted.
Kira, thank you so much. A slice of pie, I imagine, would be a good thing to sound like. But William LeBove, I think you've studied broadcast English in particular. Is that true? They want Midwestern, they want Wisconsin-sounding voices?
Well, the history of the matter is that John Kenyon, a famous English scholar, studied the language of Illinois, northern Illinois, Chicago area, and he wrote the guide for pronunciation for NBC, which is widely adopted to other people, involved things like saying that the word is not route but root. And people from other areas, particularly Ohio and Indianapolis, got very upset that this northern accent should be adopted as the standard for broadcasters, but it so happened. And this new change that we're hearing now in Wisconsin and got the job is strange because the northern area, including Wisconsin, is now moving further away from a broadcast standard.
Interesting. Thank you for bringing that up, Kira. Interesting point. Time for one more caller. I think Matt is with us in Wauwatosa. Matt, hi.
Hi. So I was serving in the military for a few years, and I got a lot of exposure to people from different areas in the U.S. And I never knew that Wisconsin really had an accent until a lot of people pointed it out to me. And the other point I wanted to comment on is kind of adapting or adopting to wherever you are. I noticed that if I hung out with people from like the Northeast Coast or Boston, like I would start picking up on phrases or wording things weird. Then I would come home and people would kind of say that my accent or my, you know, language sounded a little bit different.
Matt, thanks a lot for the call. Professor LeBeouf, is this common that people don't even, most of us don't know we have an accent? We think everybody else does?
Yes, that's the most common reaction people have. I don't have an accent. But sometimes if you move to a university or a city where you're going to be surrounded by people who speak differently, they'll point it out to you, and sometimes they make fun of you. But linguists don't feel that way. We think the change in development in the language is good for us and appreciate all the changes that are taking place around us. It makes life more interesting.
Well, that's a great place to leave it. William LeBeouf, thank you so much for joining us today. That was William LeBeouf. He's a professor of linguistics at the University of Pennsylvania. We've been talking about regional accents, prompted by a New York Times story looking at Governor Walker's accent, seeing that consciously maybe, unconsciously maybe, his Wisconsin, his northern accent seems to be softening as he prepares to enter the presidential campaign trail. You can keep this conversation going over at the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us your stories about Wisconsin accents and other regional accents, and if you're hearing a shift in our governor as he hits the national stage. Seems like the world of late night TV is in constant change lately, with big name hosts retiring and new faces stepping in. Latest bit of news came out today, a few months after Daily Show host Jon Stewart announced his plans to leave the program. Comedy Central announced his replacement, South Africa-born comedian Trevor Noah. He's known in the comedy world. He had a talk show in South Africa, but he's only been on The Daily Show a few times. Here he was talking to Jon Stewart about American efforts to hire international chess players to boost the U.S. national team.
Does America really need to be the best at everything? I mean, you already dominate the world in economics, military power, obesity.
Well, you're very kind. We have the most Dakotas.
You've got so many Dakotas.
Yes.
Well, what is it? North, South, Fanning, Johnson.
Yes.
Leave some Dakota for the rest of us.
Some of the early reactions looked at Trevor Noah's ethnic background as a biracial South African. He and Larry Wilmore, host of The Nightly Show on Comedy Central, are being cited as the biggest shift from all white late night hosts since Arsenio Hall. And Rolling Stone magazine points out another twist that foreign talk show hosts like Trevor Noah and Englishman John Oliver bring a unique perspective to their satires of the United States. Could throw former Late Show talk host Craig Ferguson from Scotland into that mix. So I'll need to clear up my own Midwestern accent if I want a shot at one of these late night TV gigs.